Hello and welcome back to the A is for Apple podcast, an encyclopedia of food and drink that takes a deep dive into our culinary culture letter by letter, hosted by food historians Neil Buttery, Ali Pino and myself, Sam Bilton. As this is season one, we have been looking at culinary items beginning with the letter A. So far, we have navigated the world of fruit, aromatics and of course, apples. The theme for the last episode was baking, where we took a metaphorical trip to Wales to try some Aberfraw cakes, discovered that Angelica could save your life if you're teetering on a mountain ledge, and I confessed to my agar anxiety. You can find this and previous episodes through the A is for Apple Substack or on your favourite podcast platform. So you two, how have you been recently?
Hi, I've been okay.
Me too, Sam. I've never been better, actually.
Ooh, it's quite a claim.
I think it's all these podcasts we're doing. I'm learning so much more about fruit, vegetables, food in general, and I'm eating a bit better, I think. I feel full of energy.
Well, that's good. Have you had any feedback from our previous episodes?
Loads of feedback. It's been so good just to see what people, all the ideas people have and how they use the different things that we've been talking about. And there's always something to learn. There's always new things to learn.
Neil, how about you?
I got some good suggestions for what we could have done for the baking episode last time.
Ooh, go on.
I must admit, I'm slightly kicking myself for not thinking of them. Apple pie. I know we've talked about apples, but there's no reason why we couldn't have done apple pie. And it's so important.
Yes, yeah.
In Britain and in, of course, North America.
Yes.
Well, actually, across most countries in the Western world, they've all got their own apple pie recipe. So I feel like we missed a trick there. Apricot crumble, somebody said, which sounds a bit niche, but I do kind of think of them together. I think only because Jane Grigson had a recipe for apricot and almond crumble. But the big one, and the annoying thing is, I was just writing about this not that long ago, ash cakes. And I don't know why.
Oh, okay. Ash cakes.
Came to mind.
I don't know much about ash cakes. Yeah.
Ash cakes were apparently the cakes that were left to burn by Alfred the Great in the old story, Anglo-Saxon story. It's just a ball of dough, really. You know, so cooked in a peasant's hearth, there's no equipment there or anything like that. So you cook your bit of dough on the embers of the fire.
Oh.
It took quite a lot of skill, actually. It sounds primitive, but actually it's really hard to do, you know, to not burn it and, you know, have it still raw in the middle. It's quite a difficult thing. So they require watching.
Nothing to do with Ash Wednesday, then?
No, I used to think that, but there's no link.
Well, having just spoken about how listening to all these food things has increased the nutritional benefits of my diet, I'm not sure this kind of thing does. Apricot crumble, apple pie, ash cakes.
Well, hey, apples, apricots, it's one of your five a day.
Absolutely. Definitely in my world. Yeah,
that's one way of looking at it.
It's a big enough slice. It's one of your five.
Well, I am hosting today's episode in which we'll be discussing what many a child dreads encountering on their dinner plate. So prepare yourself for a wrinkled nose or two, an impromptu visit to the sick room, and a few prickly surprises as Ali, Neil and I explore the verdant world of vegetables. Now, obviously, we've just discussed whether we're having all our five a day, so I hope you're feeling hale and hearty after your foray into the vegetable kingdom.
I'm feeling very, very ready to take on anything that the day brings. I've had more than my five a day. I've had 10 a day.
So, Neil, are you going to kick us off today?
Yeah. I mean, I thought it was fairly obvious. I'm sure a lot of people thought of this. I'm sure people wrote in and suggested this one just as an A. It's almost as obvious as apple. I went with asparagus.
Ah, one of my favourites.
One of my favourites as well.
Dear, not my favourite.
Is it not?
No.
Oh, well, oh, tough dear. Luck.
With apologies to Ali then.
I could have spoken about quite a lot of things. They're grown in a unique way compared to other vegetables, all sorts of types. It's a popular thing to have on allotments. There's all sorts of paraphernalia in the kitchen, lots of history. But instead, I went down the urine route. A is for asparagus. In the world of genetics, most of our traits, height, weight, intelligence, are controlled by many genes. Our traits can also be affected by our environment. But some traits, only very few, are controlled by a single gene. And that trait that you have also known as a phenotype, depends on what version of a gene you have. Different versions of the same gene are called alleles. Blood groups are an example of it, as is hitchhiker's thumb and tongue rolling. We always have two genes, one from mum, one from dad. Or the two alleles that we have in combination together will give us our phenotype. So in the case of tongue rolling, you either can tongue roll or you can't tongue roll. The gene for tongue rolling is dominant to the gene for not being able to tongue roll. So if you have two tongue rolling genes, you can tongue roll. If you have one tongue rolling gene, you can still tongue roll. But if you have none, then you cannot tongue roll. So the theory has always gone when it comes to asparagus, that there's two independent traits going on. Smelling ability and smelly compound in wee production. Each trait has two phenotypes. Either you're a smeller or a non-smeller, or you're a producer or a non-producer. So just like tongue rolling, the theory goes that it's just the same for having smelly asparagus wee and to be able to smell it. Let's just take a little look at smelling. In the case of smelling, there's two different alleles of the gene. One says you're able to smell. The other one means that you're not able to smell. Being a smeller is dominant to being a non-smeller. So in other words, if you've got two smeller alleles, you're a smeller. If you've got a smeller from one parent and a non-smeller from the other, you're still a smeller. If you have two non-smeller alleles, then you cannot smell asparagus wee. And it works for the same with production of the smelly chemical in urine, or at least so it is thought. But let's just think about phenotypes, the traits that are on display. If you can smell your own asparagus wee, as I can, this means that you're a smeller and you're a producer. If you can't smell your own asparagus wee, you might be a non-smeller, or you might be a non-producer, or both a non-smeller and non-producer. How could you find out which one you are? Well, if you can't smell your own, but you can smell your partner's, you're a smeller, but a non-producer. If your partner notices your wee smells of asparagus, then it must mean that you're a non-smeller, but you are a producer. The hypothesis that all of this is controlled by two genes, and the two genes have two different alleles, has been researched on and off for a good 75 years, and it's turned out to be a little bit more complicated than originally thought, so let's just take a quick look. In the 1950s, there was an experiment that focused upon producers and non-producers. So in other words, smelly wee and not smelly wee. And it was found if two non-producers had offspring, all their children were also non-producers. If producers had kids with producers, the majority of the kids were producers and a few were not. And if a producer had kids with a non-producer, about two-thirds were producers. And this is a classic example of data that you would get if you did in fact have something that was controlled by one gene that had two alleles. It was repeated in the 1980s and exactly the same results were found. However, it did not look into smellers. Lots of studies have tried to look at both smelling and producing, and the experiments have often had flaws. No one has ever done the definitive experiment. Why? Well, it's too expensive and it's hardly going to solve any world problems, so good luck getting a grant. But two studies in the 1980s found that there were smellers and non-smellers, but one of the studies got people to smell asparagus wee or water, which was a bad control. They should have been smelling asparagus wee and regular wee. The other study didn't find a distinct difference and couldn't really make a conclusion, so it's possibly a more complex trait controlled by more than one gene potentially and even more than two alleles. Other studies have had problems with the too simple case of either being to smell or not smell. What do you do if you can only just smell it? You might not be picked up by the study. Your ability to smell is dependent upon your health as well, whether you're a smoker or non-smoker. And during the COVID epidemic, of course, you could lose your sense of smell, but you could also become a super smeller. So people are scratching their heads about this one. So the obvious thing to look at next is, what is it that we're actually smelling? It might help us. Well, a couple of studies have compared producer and non-producer urine and found 12 different compounds present in the urine of those with smelly wee compared to those who didn't have smelly wee, making things a little more complicated. Modern genetics is able to look at not just single genes, but at a whole genome, in other words, all our genes, and how they interact together. A study was done with 23andMe, who's got a huge database now of people's DNA. It asked 10,000 people if they could smell asparagus in their urine after eating it. Most of the people could. The geneticists at 23andMe went off and did some number crunching, and they found, using statistical analyses, comparing genes and the alleles of genes of individuals who could smell asparagus wee and those who couldn't, and they found two different things. First, there seemed to be a strong association for producing smelly wee with one particular gene. But when it came to smelling the wee, they found there was 10 different genes associated with it. So what can we conclude? Well, that apparently that simple traits, smelling or not smelling, producing or not producing, can have extremely complex interactions. I would love it, listeners, if you went out, bought some local asparagus, and was hopefully very fresh, eat it with your partner or family members or friends, and smell each other's wee. That's a wholesome activity, right?
That was really interesting. I can't believe I'm saying that. Basically a segment surrounding wee. In fairness, John Evelyn did note that asparagus is a diuretic. So I'm wondering, have writers in the past debated the whole smelly wee conundrum?
Well, I think it's and Ali, I think I know which side of the fence you're going to be landing here. It's a love or hate thing as a vegetable, and it's also a love or hate thing to do with the smell, apparently.
No one wanted to do the wee experiment with me, by the way. I asked many people.
You surprised me, Ali.
Should have got your friends round. Maybe knocked on the neighbour's door.
I said it's for scientific reasons. I did actually knock on my neighbour's door upstairs, and no was the answer. Anyway.
I did one of those DNA tests at the beginning of the year, and it's funny because when you get the results back, I didn't go through 23andMe, I went through Ancestry. And it's one of the traits they test you for is whether you have smelly wee when you eat asparagus, which in the overall scheme of things, I was hoping to find some long-lost ancestors, maybe a lord or two in my history. That didn't happen. It just told me I was 90% from Essex, which I kind of already knew. And now I also have it confirmed officially by a DNA test that I produce smelly wee when I eat asparagus.
Yes, producing the wee, making the smelly compound is probably down to one gene. But whether you can smell it is down to several genes, which is a bit more tricky to pin down.
Well, I think both my parents had the gene, so it's a pretty sure cert that I was going to have it too.
I found a quote here from Lewis Lemery. I don't know how you pronounce it. Anyway, he wrote a book called The Treatise of All Sorts of Food in 1702, and he says asparagus causes a filthy and disagreeable smell in the urine, as everybody knows. However, Marcel Proust, he likes to write in a nice flowery prose form, doesn't he? This is what he
does.
All night long after a dinner at which I had partaken of asparagus, they played, lyrical and coarse in their jesting, as the fairies in Shakespeare's dream, at transforming my chamber pot into a vase of aromatic perfume.
That's one way of putting it. I mean, I was about to say, did he have asparagus-flavoured madeleines?
I thought you were going to say asparagus-flavoured wee.
Yeah. I mean, madeleine-flavoured wee would be better.
That would be better.
That would be taking the scientific approach a step too far, I feel, if you had to actually taste your wee to see whether it still tasted of asparagus after eating asparagus.
Some doctors used to do it, though, didn't they? Well, not for asparagus, but for various ailments and things like that. It's not a surprise that John Evelyn thought it was a diuretic. I'm not sure if it is, but certainly you can measure the time between eating it and weeing it out, very obviously.
Yeah.
And I think it's about 30 minutes, 40 minutes. You very much absorb it very quickly. It must be quite a small molecule, and you must absorb it very quickly and excrete it pretty quickly too. But you don't have the same comparisons with other foods. If you eat potato, your weed doesn't smell of potato.
Neil, I was just about to ask you this, but I felt a bit silly asking because I really don't know anything. But I was trying to look up, are there any other vegetables that have this same characteristic? Like if I did it with a tomato, what would happen?
Well, beetroot is one.
Right.
You get pink wee.
But not everyone or everyone?
I don't know, but
I mean. Like,
if it's
do you know what I mean?
I don't know.
Yeah.
But certainly with wee and food, definitely for me, beetroot.
Right.
And so I hear, although I've never noticed it, liver.
Oh.
You get really yellow wee with liver. No.
Okay.
I do, but I've never really thought about it before, so I'm going to have to buy some liver and give that a go. I'll pop some photos.
Send us a picture. I'll do a reel, Neil.
Yeah, I think that might get us banned from Instagram and Twitter somehow. We start posting those sort of pictures. We'll be getting a reputation for some,
Oh my God.
Having a completely different sort of podcast.
It's asparagus season as well. I ate asparagus last night, purely by coincidence, really.
I was going to ask you, Neil, because when I worked in a restaurant, you know, when asparagus season started, everyone would get really excited and all the customers would come in. Because you have it with egg and truffle, white truffle. So they were waiting for this combination.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to ask you, what's your favorite asparagus dish and combination of, if you have it? Or do you just have it quite simply with butter and nothing
else? Well, it's to do it simply. My go-to is asparagus and poached eggs on toast.
Mm, nice.
Really? It comes down to the cooking of the asparagus. I mean, does anybody even have these anymore? They used to be those special kind of tall, slender pans, asparagus pans. Do you remember? Have you got one, Sam?
I'm putting my hand up. Yeah, I have one. We had, in fairness, we planted an asparagus patch when we first moved to our house. And I don't think I actually bought the pan. I think my mum bought me the pan. Because the thing with asparagus is if you cut it fresh and you cook it like within minutes of cutting it, it tastes completely different to the stuff you buy in the shops. It tastes more grassy and less asparagusy. It's hard to explain. Mm. It still makes your wee smell, though. It doesn't have any less effect on your smelly wee. But that's why I had an asparagus pan. Sadly, the asparagus did not thrive in my heavy clay soil that I have in Sussex, so it's no longer there.
Yeah, I've tried to grow it too. Same happened to me.
What difference does it make to boil it in the pan, in that kind of vertical pan?
It stops the tips, because the tips are very tender. And if you boil them in a normal saucepan, if the bottoms of the stems are particularly woody, then you end up with mushy tops and soft bottoms or hard bottoms. And not anyway, it avoids that. So you basically steam the tops and you can, I never put that much water in mine, to be honest. So they're really,
I was going to say, don't boil your asparagus.
Well, no, Evelyn used to complain about the English overboiling asparagus. He says in his book, Acetaria, A Discourse on Salads, that Augustus, the emperor, the Roman emperor, when he ordered any business to be expedited, his proverbial saying was, let it be dispatched. Now, this is my really bad pronunciation of Latin. Sitius quam asparagi cocuntur. They cook faster than asparagus, apparently that means. Mm. So, do it, quicker than you would cook asparagus.
Yeah.
So it should be, you're right, Neil, we shouldn't boil it, should you? You should really just steam it lightly.
And listeners, you're not able to see Neil's face, but when he said, don't boil your asparagus, the face was not a nice one. It was of utter disgust. Thought of it.
Was it similar to the face your friends pulled when you asked them to come and test the asparagus wee theory, Ali?
Absolutely. Yep.
How do you cook your asparagus, Sam, by the way?
Well, I either use my completely useless saucepan that I have for anything else to lightly steam it. Or it depends. If they're young, sometimes I do sort of grill them or do them quickly in like a griddle pan, so long as they're not the stems aren't too woody. So they're sort of very thin stems. There is a William Verrill recipe for asparagus with sweetbreads, which I don't make very often, but it is nice unless you don't like sweetbreads. But
I love sweetbreads. Can't wait for season S.
And Sam, you mentioned grass and asparagus sometimes tasting a bit of grass, the fresh ones. It's funny because I had no idea that sparrowgrass was the word used instead of asparagus up until the beginning of the 19th century. And so we've got in 1667, Samuel Pepys writing in his diary, brought with me from Fenchurch Street 100 sparrowgrass. I thought that was amazing that you could just be so used to one word and then it was an entirely different word being used up until then. I don't know if they were used side by side, asparagus and sparrowgrass, but I don't think they were. I think it was just sparrowgrass.
Well, this, I think, I could be wrong here when it comes to etymologies, but I think it was, before that, it was called asparagus.
Yes, and then it went back to that, yeah.
Because it's from the Latin.
Yeah.
Sam quoted the word then, when she, from, you know, the word asparagus with that Latin quote. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there was a big sort of reaction against all this sort of flowery Latin stuff. So people decided, almost as like a tongue-in-cheek joke, to call it sparrowgrass.
Yeah.
For a long time, I thought sparrowgrass was its original name and it changed into asparagus, but no. So it was kind of frowned upon after a while to call it sparrowgrass, sort of considered, you know, the name that people who were illiterate would call it sparrowgrass.
Mm.
Then it went back to asparagus again. I think we should bring back sparrowgrass.
Yeah, it's not,
bring it back.
It's not much nicer name.
And that could be a great way to get someone to come and smell the weed that I, you know, or smell each other's weed, because I would call it by a different name. They wouldn't know that I meant, you know, so I say, come and smell my sparrowgrass, and they wouldn't know what that was.
Surreptitious wee smelling.
All in the name of science.
So how do we get white asparagus?
Well, that's a special technique. So when you're growing asparagus, as you know, Sam, it's quite hard. And it takes a couple of years of them sort of growing underneath a kind of a pile of sandy soil. At least that's what should happen. Mm. After a couple of years, then they start producing enough little stems. As when they poke out, you cut them off. So from the point of view of biomass and productivity, it's very low, hence why it's expensive. But anyway, what happens with the white asparagus, the mounds are even bigger. So as it grows, it's blanched. So it doesn't get a chance to grow any... have it get any green colour to it. And then as soon as it pops out, the tip pops out, they cut it off then, and then they sell it. And that's the white asparagus.
So they don't grow it in the dark like forced rhubarb?
I don't think so. I could be wrong there, but I think they replicate it just by piling up the mounds of sandy soil.
And is there any difference between, is there any benefit to doing this apart from the fact that you end up with a white, something
quite
niche?
Well, it's about three times more expensive for starters. Well, I mean, you get chunkier asparagus spears. They're much more delicately flavored. That bitter asparagus flavor is less.
Ah, okay.
And they're more tender. They're usually chunkier, but they're more tender than regular asparagus.
Then I'd probably like it more, because that's what I find hard with the normal asparagus. I find it very bitter.
Mm. They're good. I prefer the green, but the white's nice. If you ever see it, it's so rare that it appears, I would recommend buying it and giving it a go. But it is delicate. Certainly don't even think about boiling that. You're going to boil all the flavour out of it.
Does it still make you wee smelly?
Well, maybe, but maybe less, because it's less... There's less of that bitterness. I mean, I'm not sure if it's the same thing that I'm tasting, that I'm smelling, but they seem to have similar smells and tastes, don't they? The wee and the bitterness. Yeah. So I'm assuming it's the same stuff. Aspergic acid or something they call it, don't they?
Oh. And Neil, do you remember when you did that talk for the Museum of Royal Worcester?
Mm-hmm.
And you were talking actually about ice cream in that case, and I was just absolutely fascinated by the dishes where ice cream was kept and served.
Oh,
Is there anything like that for asparagus?
Yes, there was these little asparagus holders. There's a shape, the shape of that sort of the wafer that you used to get in ice cream, kind of like a fan shape.
Oh,
they,
cool.
They come up at the sides, and you could put your asparagus in them, so they're all kind of held together.
You wouldn't put the sauce in there. That would be served separately.
I guess the it's got high sides, so I'm assuming it's so that they remain in a nice bundle, because it used to be that they were tied up with a ribbon. There's a really famous bit of art from a Dutch artist with a tied up bunch of white asparagus, I think. But I think they use a holder so that you didn't have to tie it up, so it'd be easier to kind of take the things out of the plate. I've just laid a table, as it were, at the Museum of Royal Worcester to look like Dr. Wall's dinner. Dr. Wall was the kind of founder of Worcester porcelain. So we've taken all sorts of bits of porcelain from that first 50 years and laid it out. And of course, I had to put the asparagus servers on, because it's ridiculous that they even exist.
That must have been quite nerve-wracking. You're handling all this original...
Oh, my gosh, Neil.
18th century, is it?
Porcelain? 18th century, yeah. So, you know, 1751 to 1800.
You don't want butter fingers at that point, do you?
Do not want buttery fingers. Yes, each thing had to be placed, you know, one at a time, inside a really long case where only the middle opened. So you had to kind of really climb in.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, that was quite nerve-wracking.
Sounds quite stressful.
Yeah, we took a time-lapse video of that, which I'm sure I'll be popping on social media at some point.
Excellent.
Yeah, that sounds terrifying. I would drop everything. I get very clumsy when I'm not, you know, when I know I'm meant to be extra careful.
Yes.
I think everyone does.
So, Sam, is your choice of vegetable going to make our wee smell?
No, you'll be pleased to hear the vegetable I looked at has no effect on your wee, or none that I could find anyway. I'm going to be looking at an unusual vegetable called arrowroot. A is for arrowroot. I've always been intrigued by the invalid sections of old cookbooks. The offerings are largely bland: steamed fish or fowl paired with rice, milk jellies, or meaty teas. The recipes rarely scream delicious, and kind of seem counterproductive at a time when a patient needs to eat as part of the recovery process. I gained a new appreciation of these recipes when I became very ill myself at the end of 2010. I was unlucky enough to contract swine flu following a trip to Finland, which developed into pneumonia and a prolonged hospital stay. For the first time in my life, I completely lost my appetite. It's kind of hard to convey what this really means. I'm sure at some point in their lives, everyone feels like they've gone off their food. But in this instance, hunger had entirely evaporated. I had no more desire to eat than I would to watch the FA Cup final, or any football match for that matter. But I knew that I had to eat in order to get well. I found myself forcing food down my throat like a reluctant goose. The odd slice of toast here or a cup of soup there. Hardly sustaining, but it was as much as I could stomach. Having experienced this total disinterest in eating, I could see the benefits of giving invalids plain food. The key was clearly to get the patient to consume something nutritious that was inoffensive in flavour and easy to swallow. Some ingredients lent themselves to the sick room, and this is where today's subject comes into play. Arrowroot, or Maranta arundinacea, is a tropical root vegetable originally native to the West Indies and South America, where it has been cultivated for thousands of years. It is now widely grown in Asia and Africa and the Pacific Islands as well. Above ground, it produces stems over a meter in height, bearing numerous leaves and white flowers. But the most important part of this plant lies underground. The elongated tubers are harvested when they are gorged with starch. They can be boiled or roasted, then eaten whole, although they are very fibrous. Alternatively, the roots can be washed, peeled, and pulverized. Then the paste is sieved to separate the starch, which is then dehydrated to produce a gluten-free powder. Arrowroot starch has particularly fine grains, which means it is easily digested. This made it popular as a sickroom ingredient in the Victorian era and beyond. In 1852, in A Plain Cookery Book for the Working Classes, Charles Francatelli advised boiling a dessert spoon of arrowroot with half a pint of water, 4 lumps of sugar, and a glass of wine until thickened before feeding it to the patient. Besides starch, arrowroot contains very few nutrients. This fact was not lost on the doyenne of the sickroom, Florence Nightingale, who, in her Notes on Nursing, had this to say on the subject. Arrowroot is a grand dependence of the nurse. To mix the patient's wine in, being as it is quickly prepared, it is all very well. But it is nothing but starch and water. Flour is both more nutritive and less liable to ferment, and is preferable wherever it can be used. Arrowroot was not only used in the sick room, it was also utilised as a thickening agent for sauces. But perhaps the most popular use of this powder was in a type of pudding, not dissimilar to a modern-day blancmange. Isabella Beaton says arrowroot is good for creating jellies that will stay firm for 3 to 4 days. However, she does warn that arrowroot adulterated with potato starch will cause the jelly to become as thin as milk within the course of 12 hours. There were no arrowroot concoctions for me during my bout of pneumonia, only copious doses of antibiotics, which eventually saw my health restored and appetite revived. But I do use arrowroot in my kitchen today, mainly as a thickening agent for fruit compotes. However, researching this ingredient did motivate me to try some Victorian recipes, and I'm sure Ali and Neil will want to hear all about that.
Wow, Sam, that was really interesting. Can you tell us a bit more about these recipes then?
Arrowroot was used a lot in the sick room, and it did produce, they did get recipes like Mrs. Beaton, for example, has these recipes for these blancmanges. And actually, it's interesting, her original book from 1861, she suggests flavouring it with bay leaves or lemon. And I tried that, and actually it was really nice. I mean, I'm not a massive blancmange fan. I know, Ali, we've discussed this before. You don't go there with jelly.
No, I don't.
And what was I found really interesting is because sometimes they put things in books and you think, oh, they're talking absolute rubbish, because in the modern world, obviously, we've got electronic equipment. So we can beat egg whites till they're super stiff and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. But she did say, like, it only holds. It's a bit like Cinderella and, you know, the fancy dress disappearing at midnight. She says it only holds for like 3 or 4 days. And I did my classic thing of where I was doing lots of recipe testing, bunged it in the fridge, and I used for the first time ever a mold that I got from my grandmother's house, which I've been desperate to use for years. And it's got like a wheat sheaf on the top. So it's quite fairly ornate in a
nice,
in a quite a basic way, not quite like the stuff Ivan Day does. But it was anyway, I used that and I thought, this is so never coming out of the mold. I'm just going to have a splodge. It's either just going to be liquid, it won't set, or it's just going to be stuck like glue. Mm-hmm. And actually, it did come out, but I had left it for about 3 days. And I took a picture, and then she recommends serving it with stewed rhubarb. So I took a picture without the rhubarb and turned around, got my stewed rhubarb, and it has started to collapse. So I will put a before and after picture on Instagram so everyone can see. But it did look very nice for about, you know, about 3 minutes, and then it started to collapse. But that was, I think, because I didn't turn it out straight away. But flavor-wise, the blancmange was good. Mm-hmm. But in later issues, she drops the bay leaf, which I thought was interesting, because I think bay we should use a lot more than just sticking it in a stew.
I was going to say that. Using sweet food, it's really nice. If you're making a sugar syrup, popping a bay leaf in is really good.
I think it's one of the best flavours to have. And now, admittedly, if you don't, I've got a massive bay tree growing in my garden, so it's easy for me to get bay leaves. But if you don't have access to them, it's not quite, the dried ones are never quite the same.
Don't even bother buying dried bay leaves.
No.
That's my controversial statement.
I can see how people would use arrowroot as an alternative to using gelatin, because it did set, it did come out mold, it didn't stick, and it looked fabulous for about 3 minutes. Mm. But that's my bad, because I didn't listen to Mrs. Beaton, which I should have done.
And it didn't taste weird. I mean, you have to remember the time Mrs. Beaton's writing, didn't write any of it, but you know what I mean, writing in inverted commas, her book, is when gelatin and isinglass were being used. So you either had to make your own calf's foot jelly or extract it from the gallbladder of the fish yourself, or buy the stuff, which then, you know, it was still, the isinglass was a bit fishy.
Yeah, and the
gelatin was a bit definitely porky.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it took a while. It's not until you get to maybe very late 19th century, like 1898, 99, do you actually get decent gelatin that's cheap. So you can see why people would use arrowroot. Yeah. And certainly working classes who wanted to have a pudding like the posh people did were very much making starch-based blancmanges. That's why they became sort of well-known and popular, rather.
Yeah, I can see that, definitely, having used it.
And what about before Mrs. Beaton? Like with Raffold, for example, she wasn't using arrowroot.
No, I don't think there are any arrowroot. No. That kind of blancmange didn't exist then.
Right.
It was all very much, in the 18th century, basically a jelly.
Right.
You know, made from gelatin or from calf's foot jelly, which you're extracting yourself, for sure.
Now, the cake, because she had a cake recipe.
And I saw you tweeted in something about this,
yeah.
I think.
So she has a recipe in there for a snow cake. And I was intrigued by the snow cake because arrowroot is gluten-free. And I thought, actually, this could be quite nice.
It sounds nice, snow cake.
It sounds nice, doesn't it? It does sound nice. And it's got egg whites in it, so there's no egg yolks, hence the snow reference.
Why have I got the feeling it's not nice?
And it's just got arrowroot is the only starch
in it.
That's
the only flour, right?
Only flour, yeah. So imagine, if you can, that you've been given a big bag of candy floss and you've stuck some in your mouth. And normally candy floss dissolves, but instead of dissolving, it just expands and saps the moisture. It just absorbs every single molecule of moisture in your mouth.
Yeah.
And it has a really very bizarre aftertaste. Yeah, it was not pleasant. In fact, it was so unpleasant. I was Mrs. Beaton says, calls it a snow cake, a genuine Scotch recipe.
Scotch.
Yeah. Scotch, yeah, recipe. And Marion McNeil repeats it in the Scots kitchen, which I was amazed at because it is utterly disgusting. I would, if I were a self-respecting Scot, I would not want this dish associated with my country. And I actually don't know why it would be, because it's not from Scotland, that I could tell.
Jane Grigson's got a rice cake in English food where it's exactly the same.
Oh.
What you described, but you use ground rice instead of wheat flour. And exactly the same thing happened when I made that. I just couldn't. Why has she put this in?
Yeah. It's,
why has she put it in? Awful.
We're food historians, so we all make stuff from, if you like, an archaeological approach to see what things should have been like or would have been like back in the day. Yeah, why you would repeat this recipe. And I am pleased to say that, again, I've got a later issue. I think my big issue with Mrs. Beaton's is from the 1920s, and the snow cake has disappeared, quite rightly.
Because
it shouldn't see the light. It should not have seen the light of day. It is utterly vile. And if you wanted to make someone sick, that would be a jolly good way to get them into the sick room, because it was really possibly one of the most disgusting things I've ever made in my entire life.
I feel for you with your sick room food, though, having all that time feeling sick, feeling ill.
Yeah.
Even when I had COVID, I lost my sense of taste and smell and all that. But even COVID didn't compare to having
pneumonia. But you still get hungry, even though the food tastes
absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You can't smell it or anything, but you still feel the hunger pangs. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Do you guys have a favourite food for when you're in the sick room? Obviously not the arrowroot cake.
Not the arrowroot cake, no arrowroot pudding either. Well, tea and toast is a classic. I mean, when I was a kid, chicken noodle soup.
Mm.
Knorr's chicken noodle soup from a packet, specifically.
Mm.
I remember very well.
I have white rice, boiled rice with parmesan and a baked apple. And that's all I can, because it's bland. But it's not totally insipid, because a little bit of flavour from the parmesan, which is also helps you with your bowels. And a baked apple, which is sometimes it's hard to kind of bite into things if you're not feeling well. So it's a bit softer, maybe a little bit of brown sugar. I look forward to being ill next so I can have that.
I mean, the thing to give people if they really couldn't stroke wouldn't eat, and Lindsay Middleton's done a lot of research on dishes of the sick room, hasn't she?
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, my favourite is one that always leaps out at me when I look in a book of that sort of era, Mrs. Beaton era, and that's the toast water, where you toast some toast quite well, and then you use it almost like a tea bag to just flavour the water a little bit, filter it out or something through a sieve, and then drink the toast water.
Yeah.
Why would you?
I keep getting to try it.
I can't see why you would do that. I mean, I know, obviously, they probably thought that some of the nutrition from the bread leached into the water, but I just can't see why you would. It doesn't sound appetizing at all.
I mean, beef tea is a similar thing where you just take lots of slices of beef. You very slowly poach it in water for a few hours and strain it off. You got the beef tea. But if you were really sick, you would use raw beef to make the beef tea, which sounds like you're going to finish them off, if anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially in a day's pre-refrigeration.
But it's such a strong association between strength and meat, though, isn't there?
Mm. They really believed, though, that the essence of a food was extracted into the water, the goodness.
Yes.
So I suppose having raw beef means you're getting unadulterated, pure goodness. You know, it fit the logic at the time.
Yeah.
Yes. And there's a really good book it's Nick Fiddis, and it's all about meat, and it's called Meat, a Natural Symbol. Nick Fiddes, Fiddes. I don't know how you pronounce this. But I saw, Sam, that you put in a quote by Florence Nightingale. And I mean, she wasn't keen on arrowroot, was she?
No, I mean, she makes the point that it's just starch. There's absolutely no nutrients in it whatsoever. And it's to prove the point Mrs. Beaton was just copy and pasting, effectively, or the Victorian equivalent of.
Yeah.
Earlier in Mrs. Beaton's Book of Household Management, she She waxes lyrical about the miraculous benefits of eating arrowroot foods and then goes on in the sick room section to quote Florence Nightingale. So she obviously hadn't done her copy reading very thoroughly. I mean, no. It is a massive book, to be fair to her. No, she said it really is just starch. And if you're just going to make something gloopy to give to a patient, you might as well use flour because there's far more nutrients into it.
Yeah.
And she also makes that comment about the fermenting, Neil. I don't know whether you know have any views on this, which I thought was quite strange because I can't imagine, I don't know, I haven't tried, but why arrowroot would be more prone to fermenting than wheat flour?
No, I don't know either. I can't imagine it being any different.
Mm. Yeah, it's I've very bizarre.
I've got a bone to pick with the Diner's Dictionary because in this book, they put in a quote from Florence Nightingale, and it says arrowroot was valued for its easy digestibility, and Florence Nightingale praised it as a grand dependence of the nurse, which you also put in, but then you put in the full quote, and we get to know Florence Nightingale's real opinion on that. And I thought,
which is a lesson for the day. You should always go to the original source. So often people
100%
take out the quote and they take the bit that works for them. Didn't you say you came across a mention of arrowroot in Jane Austen's Emma?
I did. And it was, you'll say, what we've been talking about, you know, that arrowroot is considered to be something nutritious. And so Emma sends it to Jane Fairfax, actually, and wishing her well. And they'd had a bit of a difficult relationship. And so there's a mention of arrowroot as poison just because Jane is a little bit, you know, doesn't trust Emma. And so it's all about that. So the fact that arrowroot is considered to be so healthy and that it's then she sees it as poison is there to prove the fact that it was really considered to be the healthiest of things. And so there's just this brief mention of it. I don't really see it much as a food item in literature or generally just in everyday life. And I wanted to ask you the question, Sam, can you walk into a supermarket and buy arrowroot?
Yeah, it's in the baking section. So you get it and it's mostly used nowadays as a thickening agent, which they also did use it in the Victorian times for that as well. It wasn't just used in the sick room. So it's great for thickening fruit compotes because it doesn't go cloudy. So if you use corn flour, for example, you still get cloudiness. Whereas with arrowroot, you get a thicker sauce, but it's clear. What I would say is if you continue to cook it for too long, it loses its viscosity or whatever. It reverts back almost to being runny. So it's quite a temperamental ingredient to use. But yeah, you can buy it really easily in the supermarket. Okay. You don't need much, about a teaspoon for, you know, so if you just want to thicken a fruity sauce.
It's really weird because the sort of French or French-trained chefs of the 19th century, so you're Escoffiers and your Carems and Francatellis were really complaining about flour, wheat flour for thickening sauces. They would say, oh, everything, you can taste the flour. We want to have something that's completely neutral so that the flavor of the sauce can completely shine. And then things like arrowroot were created, you know, powdered, ditto for corn flour, corn starch. So they got what they wanted. And then they complained that it didn't have any character.
Yeah.
Went back to wheat flour again. It's like, God, there's no pleasing
people.
No, you can't, can you? No.
Poor arrowroot can't win.
I mean, I still occasionally use arrowroot in sauces, savoury sauces as well, if I've got it in the cupboard. I mean, obviously, since my cooking experience, I have quite a lot of it in the cupboard.
I feel there's an elephant in the room, Sam.
What's the elephant?
An aphrodisiac?
No.
Oh, okay.
No. Calm down.
Whoa, Ali.
No, is arrowroot a vegetable? What is arrowroot?
It is a vegetable. So it is grown in Central and South America, I believe. It has been eaten where it grows as a vegetable, but it apparently is very fibrous. So it's evidently not very pleasant to eat. It's one of those foods that people eat out of necessity rather than eating because of the pleasure of it. Hence the reason why they started extracting the starch and just took that element away and got rid of all the fibrous crap. But yes, it is a vegetable. It is classed as a vegetable. I did check before I did my research that it was classed as a vegetable. Well, Ali, we've had asparagus and arrowroot so far. What are you bringing to the vegetable party?
I'm bringing artichokes.
A is for artichoke. The artichoke, with its thorny exterior and tender heart, has a rich history that intertwines with themes of violence, fury and passion in art and literature. I'll be looking at artists Giovanna Garzoni and Caravaggio, painters of the Baroque period, and 20th century author Angela Carter, known for her Baroque prose and how the artichoke featured in their works and lives. The artichoke is a thistle-like perennial plant native to the Mediterranean region. It has been cultivated for centuries for its edible flower buds and tender hearts, which are prized for their delicate flavour and nutritional value. The edible portions of the buds consist primarily of their fleshy base known as the heart. The mass of immature florets in the centre of the bud is called the choke or beard. Artichoke. What a peculiar name. Now, the English word artichoke was borrowed in the 16th century from the northern Italian word artichocco, the standard modern Italian being carciofo. Now, the Italian term was itself borrowed either from Spanish alcachofa or directly from the source of the Spanish word medieval Andalusi Arabic al-carchufa, including the Arabic definite article al. Forms found in English have included artichoke, corresponding to heart, and choke, which were likely associated with the belief that the inedible centre of the vegetable could choke its eaters, or that the plant could take over a garden, choking out the other plants. Leroy Ladurie, in his book Les Paysans de Languedoc, documented the spread of artichoke cultivation in Italy and southern France in the late 15th and early 16th centuries, when the artichoke appeared as a new arrival with a new name, which may be taken to indicate an arrival of an improved cultivated variety. The blossom of the thistle, improved by the Arabs, from Naples was brought to Florence by Filippo Strozzi in 1466, and the surname Strozzi in Italian comes from the verb strozzare, which means to choke. This is a coincidence I could not avoid mentioning, though be it entirely useless. Now, the Dutch introduced artichokes to England, where they grew in Henry VIII's garden at Newhall in 1530. From the mid-17th century, artichokes were very fashionable in European courts. The hearts were considered luxury ingredients in the new court cookery, as recorded by writers such as François-Pierre Lavarenne. It was also claimed in this period that artichokes had aphrodisiac properties. They were taken to the United States in the 19th century, to Louisiana, by French immigrants, and to California by Spanish immigrants. The artichoke's prickly exterior and tender heart have made it a potent symbol in art and literature. For example, in Giovanna Garzoni and in Caravaggio in Italy, influential artists of the Baroque period. Giovanna Garzoni, born in 1600, was one of the most accomplished still life painters of the 17th century. She often incorporated natural objects like fruits, vegetables, and flowers into her compositions. And in one of her paintings from 1650, she depicts with brilliant colours and meticulous technique artichokes in a Chinese dish with rose and strawberries. Though she was in Venice at the beginning of her career, she was later employed in Naples, serving at the court of a Spanish duke. Naples was the city which witnessed a crescendo of glorious Baroque work, such as Caravaggio's, who had also moved there from Rome. Caravaggio, known for his dramatic use of light and shadow, often depicted scenes of violence, passion, and emotional turmoil in his paintings. The curved shape of the artichoke could be defined in itself Baroque, a style whose lines gives a sense of mobility and vitality. This vegetable is over the top, and it finds itself in over the top situations, perhaps because it is aesthetically unusual and used to being very difficult to get hold of. So let's go back to Rome for a second. It was a hot, humid night in the dark back streets of the Eternal City, between the Pantheon and Campo dei Fiori, when Caravaggio threw a dish of artichokes aimed at the head of a waiter. Caravaggio had ordered 8 artichokes, 4 cooked in butter and 4 in olive oil. They arrived on the same dish. "So which is which?" he asked. "Sniff them and see," said the insolent waiter. Hence Caravaggio's rage and violent gesture. Don't mess around with Caravaggio, and don't mess around with artichokes either. Let's not forget that they are still considered a luxury at this point. their visual appearance, all-rounded Baroque fronds. They were a rare and expensive treat, and they deserved to be respected. Now, talking of Baroque, Angela Carter, an English novelist born in 1940, had a style of writing which has often been described as Baroque, and there is an extravagance which characterises her work, which I really love. 1979 saw the publication of The Bloody Chamber, a retelling of the Bluebeard story. Here, she uses the tough outer layers of the artichoke, and they need to be peeled away to get to the heart as a parallel to describe a moment between the story's protagonists. No spoilers, don't worry, but I will say this. A very physical image, which involves the stripping of our heroine's dress, provides a metaphor for the unpeeling of the bride's layers. I quote from The Bloody Chamber, "He stripped me as if he was stripping the leaves off an artichoke, but do not imagine much finesse about it. This artichoke had no particular treat for the diner, nor was he yet in any greedy haste. He approached his familiar treat with a weary appetite." For the Bluebeard in this story, this much sought-after lady is already becoming less desired. He's used to luxury, and though the artichoke might seem so special at the start, it becomes less and less important as he consumes more of it, and more of her. Another example of how the artichoke is a vegetable that evokes strong sentiments. I wonder if it does so for you too.
Can I ask about artichokes, globe artichokes, and growing them? Do people still grow artichokes? Because you don't really see them in the shop. They're very expensive in the shops.
Yeah,
they seem to have become a decorative plant now.
Yes.
Rather than a food.
I do grow them, but
do
I do grow them as a decorative
wow.
plant because I never get more than like a couple of small artichokes. I've actually just moved my artichoke plants because I didn't think they were doing very well where they were positioned. So I'm hoping to have more luck with them in their new location. But yes, I grow them as a decorative plant because I actually think they look beautiful.
They do look nice. Like cardoons. Cardoons are grown for their sort of, well, they're the same family. They're all kind of thistles, aren't they?
Yeah.
With a cardoon, you can eat the stem, you see, because I've been looking for differences as well, because
that's
I'm a
right.
Do you know what? My confusion arises just from like not knowing, why would you even look at something like an artichoke and think, I'll eat that? Like, it's not really something that is appetizing.
It's got to have been originally some kind of farming food, I think, because there's a huge amount of plant. It's a great big thistle. I'm sure it was probably thorny before it started being, you know, selectively grown. There's a lot of plant, very little flower bud, and then when you take the flower bud, you take most of that and chuck it in the bin before you even eat it. So I'm assuming that, I mean, that's why it's expensive, of course. Also, it's a massive faff to make, but how else are you going to discover that the base of a flower from a thistle is edible, other than if you're completely starving? There's only one way you're going to even bother investigating, surely.
I hadn't thought of that. I think they were considered to be quite exotic, and I think the looks contributed to this. And they were said to be the favourite vegetable of Henry VIII, who brought artichokes, globe artichokes.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had a lot of listeners asking about globe in particular. There seems to be a preference for this kind, but there are many, many different kinds. Henry VIII brought the plant to the English court, and this was following fashions in mainland Europe. And so this gave, I think, this connection between artichokes and luxurious dining. And I think that's never really gone in a way. We still have this idea just because it is so difficult. They are quite difficult to make. I mean, not when you get used to it and you have familiarity with it.
They're extremely popular in Italian cookery, aren't they still?
100%.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
I look forward to eating them every time. I go back in April to eat them because I eat them every day. I eat them in different ways. Every day I can eat artichokes.
I buy the ones in oil.
Yeah.
Well, I love the ones in oil. Mm. So they're preserved in oil, and those are the baby ones. Those are delicious. And then you can just do them yourself. And then you can serve them with salumi, like salame, prosciutto, etc. When you have, when you're doing an aperitivo or whatever, and then it just becomes an easy way to integrate a vegetable as well.
So when you see the recipes for young artichokes, do you have to remove the choke bit, you know, the fluffy bit inside, or do you just cook them whole? Because I imagine it would be really hard to take anything out. Or does the choke develop as the flower effectively develops?
Yes. I mean, you can, yes, they are, you totally eat them whole. I mean, even with maybe bigger ones, you don't have to remove the choke. It depends how tender they are. And there are many different types. So it's just with the bigger ones, which are not the ones that I find in Italy, you see. I don't really deal with the big ones in Italy. There's only so small that you never have to take the choke out. But if you do need to take it out, you would cut it in half and then remove it once you've cut it in half. And sometimes you can even eat them raw in a salad. So you slice, yes. The important thing is to take the outer leaves away because they are spiky. I cut the leaves at the top because they are sharp, so you can cut them. I see that they recommend tearing the stalk and not cutting, but I cut the stalk. Yeah, and there are just many, many different ways that you can incorporate them. We do use cheese in them, but not too much. They're not covered in cheese. It's just a little bit inside. And we have a recipe, which is something that how we cook them where I'm from, which is near Naples, where you would use egg, put some Parmesan in and parsley, pour it inside in the middle of the artichoke, and then you kind of stand them up. We'd need kind of an asparagus pan, but a bit wider. And then you don't roast them. You just put them in a pan with water, a little bit of water, a little bit of oil, and you leave them there 20 minutes. And maybe you would then add an extra little tiny bit of cheese on top to melt. Yeah. Mm. And the heart is the thing that everyone wants. And so, when I'm with my family, we try and steal each other's hearts, and it's great fun.
Giancomo Castelvetro, he said that some people don't eat artichokes with cheese because it gives them catarrh.
Yes.
But they are unaware of how it improves the flavour.
The flavour is delicious on its own. When you cover it with cheese, I don't see how you would taste the flavour of the artichoke. That's the thing. It's not such a strong flavour that
you
would need to be covering it up. It's just, yes, I like it actually without cheese, just with garlic, parsley, and that's it really. Mm.
Yeah. I need to revisit them. I've only ever tried to make them once. It was very much at the very beginning of my, in inverted commas, career. And it didn't work. They went all brown because I didn't know you had to rub them with lemon. I think I overcooked things. I had no frame of reference.
No.
How long to do it for. It was a bit of a disaster. I probably didn't even buy very good quality ones. So yeah. I think I should maybe have a go. They're in season at the minute in the UK. And there's a nice little sort of seasonal grocery store near me. Yeah. So it's just organic fruit and veg. And I saw artichokes in there when I was in there last, so maybe I should have a go.
You know, if you find the small ones, Neil, because I agree with you, it's such a faff, and sometimes, you know, we don't have time. If you find the small ones, my grandmother used to just put them in egg and then fry them, maybe with some breadcrumbs, maybe with some flour, but just fry them as they are and eat them like little frittelle. Delicious. I love
them. The whole thing,
but because they're baby ones. Yes, they're small ones. The lemon, I don't do the lemon, but I know that it's done because you want to prevent discoloration, but I tend not to do that. So, yeah.
Why were they so popular with artists? And is it purely because they are an attractive plant? There's no getting away from that, I don't think. Or is it because of their value? Because as Neil said, they were quite a posh thing to have, weren't they?
They were a posh thing to have. And, you know, truffle is a posh thing to have, because I was thinking about this, but we don't get many paintings of truffles. I think the artichoke is a beautiful plant. It represents resilience and protection and security, which is why I was also looking into why so many people have the artichoke tattooed on them. So it's not, yes, it's painted and it's in important paintings. And also in art as we know it now, maybe tattoo art, we have a lot of artichokes because it symbolizes security, resilience. And so I think it's associated to that, and it's a beautiful plant to draw because, yeah, there are lots of things, like caviar is expensive, but you don't get many paintings of caviar. I wouldn't get a tattoo of caviar. I would prefer an artichoke.
Have you seen the picture by Jacopo Ligozzi of the monkey and the artichoke? I don't know whether you can see that.
Yes, this is from a book of Aldo Varandi. No, he's a naturalist.
Yeah.
And
I wouldn't give, I, you know, if they were that expensive, I think John Evelyn said they sold for a crown a piece. I wouldn't be giving my artichokes to a monkey doll, even posing for a picture.
That's the whole point, because the ape is nearest to man. So it's a symbol of the humanity of the ape, because it's holding the artichoke. It recognizes that it's...
Recognizes its worth.
Yes.
Its symbolism.
Its symbolism of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was also linked to a Greek myth, wasn't it? Zeus kidnapped a beautiful woman, and because she got lonely and wanted to go back, he decided to return her to Earth as a thistle.
Yes.
I mean, quite spiteful on the part of Zeus, but I mean, you can't help feeling that Zeus deserved a good slap.
Oh my God, Zeus was just brutal. You know, poor Cynara was missing her mum. It's not like she just wanted to go out partying. And so she snuck out to visit her on Earth, and this enraged Zeus. And then as a punishment, Cynara was transformed into an artichoke and tossed onto the ground. And so we have the scientific name for artichoke, Cynara carduncolus, which derives from this myth.
Well, thank you both. That was really fascinating. I've learned loads of stuff about asparagus, including lots about asparagus wee and artichokes. And I even found it interesting looking into arrowroot, although I'm not going to repeat some of the cooking experiments after, particularly not the cake. So everyone, after listening to this episode, are you inspired to cook with asparagus, artichokes, or even arrowroot? Let us know via the chat section of the A is for Apple Substack, or on Instagram at A is for Apple Pod _, or Twitter at A is for Apple Pod. But you can keep the bit about whether you're an asparagus wee producer or smeller to yourself. I don't think that's a bit of oversharing.
No, don't keep it to yourself.
Yeah, you really want to hear about that? Don't forget, you can follow the podcast on social media and Substack to ensure you never miss an episode. And if you enjoy the show, please rate and review it on your preferred podcast platform, as it will help other listeners find the A is for Apple podcast. You can hear more from Neil on the British Food History podcast, where he recently covered the Scottish salt industry, Ormskirk gingerbread, and cooking historical food. Ali can be found on the Fear Feast podcast, which explores the horror genre in films and literature through the use and symbolism of food, which she co-hosts with Vanessa Backer. And I have just concluded the second season of the Comfortably Hungry podcast, which explores some of the more unusual aspects of chocolate history. You can find links to our other podcasts and personal social media accounts in the show notes. And that's where you'll also find links to many of the books and articles that inspired today's episode. So do check it out. We'll be back soon with another instalment of the A is for Apple podcast when Ali is taking the reins. So what do you have in store for us, Ali?
Well, I thought we could take on the topic of meat. What do you think?
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's fairly broad.
It's very broad.
It is fairly broad. Okay. I'm trying to think off the top of my head, meat beginning with A.
Yeah. Maybe listeners have some suggestions.
Oh, yes. Yes. Do indeed. Let us know.
I guess it's not just meats, kinds of meats. It's things made from meat too.
Oh, yes. It could be anything. Anything to do with meat.
Yeah. Okay. Fine. Well, I haven't thought of anything off the top of my head, but I'm sure something will appear.
Yes.
No, it's a good choice.
Okay.
Great. Yeah. Looking forward to it too. So I will see you both next time. Goodbye.
See you later.
Bye-bye.